Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young. Coming up, the ambush in Samarra. Have the insurgents in Iraq switched strategies?
And is the U.S. ready to release prisoners from Guantanamo Bay in Cuba?
On World AIDS Day, a plan to get simplified care to 3 million people with AIDS in the developing world.
What is currently being done is a little bit chaos and it's unnecessary. And we need to ensure that the minimum standards of care are being provided.
Also, Venezuela's president survived an attempted coup and 4 general strikes. Can he slip his latest noose?
And some political heavy lifting. President Bush is expected to remove the steel tariffs.
These stories and classical CD stocking stuffers coming up here and now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The Army says American troops killed 54 Iraqi insurgents in a fierce battle to repel coordinated ambushes on U.S. convoys in the city of Samarra over the weekend. But NPR's Ivan Watson says some people there are telling a different story.
Angry residents are claiming that U.S. forces plowed into their city, literally steamrolling over vehicles here and basically shooting up the town. And there is evidence of sustained gunfire in a number of squares in the town, restaurants and shops, as well as vehicles that were shot up or apparently rolled over by armored vehicles. And in the hospital, doctors claim it treated dozens of children and women, saying they saw no injured fighters at all, only civilian casualties.
NPR's Ivan Watson in Samarra, Iraq. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld says he is confident that his European Union counterparts will not reach any agreements that would undercut or duplicate the U.S.-led NATO alliance.
I'm confident and hopeful that things will sort through in a way that we end up with an arrangement that is not duplicative or competitive.
Rumsfeld was speaking at a news conference today in Brussels. The U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to decide if federal agents can enter foreign countries and arrest suspected criminals and then bring them to the U.S. to stand trial. The Bush administration says that rarely used tactic is an important tool in the war against terrorism, but a lower court disagreed. Colorado's Supreme Court says Republican lawmakers there violated the state's constitution when they redrew congressional districts last year. Democrats say that decision could help them win 2 of the state's 7 congressional districts in the next election. NPR's Jeff Brady has the story.
The state Supreme Court says redistricting maps can be drawn only once every 10 years, after the federal census and before the first election of the decade. But in 2000, lawmakers couldn't agree on a map, so a judge settled the case and forced one on them. Republicans subsequently developed another map, more to the party's liking. Democrats sued. Republicans argued the judge's redistricting map was temporary and that it's the legislature's job to draw political boundaries. The Supreme Court rejected that argument. Republicans say that if a similar case in Texas is decided differently, they may appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. Jeff Brady, NPR News, Denver.
Attorneys for convicted sniper John Allen Muhammad say he will not testify at the trial of his alleged accomplice, Lee Boyd Malvo. Malvo's lawyers wanted Muhammad to be brought into the courtroom nevertheless so the jury could at least see him, but the judge has rejected that request. Malvo's attorneys are trying to convince the jury that he was brainwashed by Muhammad. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow is up 91 points at 9,873, and the NASDAQ is up 22 at 1982. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, stocks have gained ground in trading so far today. All the major averages are in positive territory, and the S&P 500 index is at an 18-month high. A barometer of manufacturing activity rose in November. The Institute for Supply Management says its index rose nearly 9% last month, exceeding analyst expectations. A former Motorola executive says he was wrongfully fired, and he's now suing the company for $1 million. Lisa Lava says the story.
Motorola was paid $32 million in July to develop cell phone software for a Hong Kong-based telecommunications company. Robert Krolop says he and other managers repeatedly requested to use part of that money to complete the work, but weren't allowed to until it was too late to meet the contract's deadline. Krolop says he found out Motorola was using the cash to cover operating deficits instead. He complained to a company vice president. 2 weeks later, Krolop was suspended without pay. He was then fired for reportedly engaging in a relationship with a female co-worker under his supervision. Krolop denies having supervised that worker. Motorola says it cannot comment on pending litigation. For NPR News, I'm Lisa Labus in Chicago.
The chairman and CEO of Boeing has resigned. In a surprise announcement today, the company said Phil Condit is stepping down immediately because the aerospace firm needs a new leadership structure. Condit's departure comes just days after two other top Boeing officials were fired for alleged breaches of ethics involving defense contracts. DuPont says it's moving to ensure its global competitiveness in a more focused science-based company. Company's planning job cuts and other changes with a goal of achieving $900 million in savings. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the N.E.E. Casey Foundation, supporting families and neighborhoods by funding initiatives aimed at helping disadvantaged children, on the web at aecf.org.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Iraqis in the central Iraq city of Samarra are disputing U.S. military accounts of the fierce battle that took place there, a battle that may prove the bloodiest since President Bush declared the end of combat last May. The U.S. military says 54 Iraqis were killed in the firefight, some of them wearing uniforms of Saddam Hussein's Fedayeen. Many Iraqis say the number of dead is much lower and that most of them were civilians. Nick Blandford is a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. He joins us on the line from Baghdad, about 60 miles south of Samarra. Hello, Nick.
Hi.
Do we know any more about the dead in Samarra?
Well, not as yet. I think this is going to be one of those cases which run, and it's going to be very hard to get to the actual truth. Casualty statistics are notoriously difficult to assess in Iraq. The Americans told us that 46 Iraqi combatants were killed, and they later revised that up to 54 fatalities, Iraqi fatalities. How many of them are civilians, we don't know. But the American count is apparently based on eyewitness accounts, that is, talking to the soldiers that took part in the fighting. So it wasn't, I think, a strict body count of corpses found by the soldiers afterwards. The local people said that there were considerably less people killed and that the bulk of them were civilians. I think it's going to be one of those things where we'll have to wait a few days until the dust settles before we get a more accurate picture of what happened.
Well, the civilians seem to also be questioning what happened, in other words, what the event was. The U.S. is saying it was an ambush, a very well orchestrated ambush of two convoys delivering new currency to the city. How much do we know about the event itself?
Well, we know mainly what the Americans told us, that they were exchanging new Iraqi dinar for old, that it was a coordinated attack of between 60 and 80 militants split up into two main groups.
Mm-hmm. The U.S. is also reporting this week that attacks against soldiers has decreased by about a third since mid-November. On the other hand, attacks against Iraqis seem to be cooperating with the coalition forces is up dramatically. But this recent attack, of course, directly against an allied convoy will probably change that statistic a little.
Up to a point, yes. I think that what we're seeing is the classic rules of guerrilla warfare here. We had 2 weeks ago, the Americans launched two major military operations, one in Baghdad and one further north around Tikrit, Saddam Hussein's hometown. And the Americans were using what they call actionable intelligence, and this is intelligence given by the local people, which they used to go after militants in raiding houses and this sort of thing. Now, what seems to have happened is that the number of attacks have decreased in the areas where the military operations were conducted, i.e. Baghdad and Tikrit, but the attacks have increased elsewhere in the country. The militants have moved up to the north, and they've also been operating further south of Baghdad. So it would seem that they're simply changing their tactics. We're seeing less and less hit-and-run operations, although yesterday, of course, was an example exactly of that. But the militants are using more and more roadside bomb attacks. The bombs are becoming more sophisticated. And if you have a look at the breakdown of American casualties over the last 6 months, you'll see that the bulk of casualties these days are being caused by these roadside bomb attacks.
And one last question. What does this, you know, ambush, if that's in fact what it was, what does that say about a possible change in tactics?
Well, I think the part of the trick of guerrilla warfare is that you have the initiative. The militants have the initiative. It's a very big country out there, and they can attack where and when and how they want. So one day we could see some attacks by roadside bombs, and other times we could see the sort of incident of yesterday in Samarra of a mass ambush, you know, a lot of militants taking on an armored convoy. This is the classic sort of symptoms of guerrilla warfare. So it's very hard to predict specific patterns emerging over a short period of time. Maybe the guerrillas are becoming more emboldened, and we'll start seeing more hit-and-run, direct hit-and-run attacks again rather than roadside bombs. The initiative, as I say, is with them, and they dictate the course of events.
Mm. Well, Nick, thank you.
You're welcome.
Nick Blandford, reporter for the Christian Science Monitor, speaking to us from Baghdad.
Could some Islamic prisoners held at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, on suspicion of being terrorists, finally go free after being held now without charge for as long as 2 years? Well, according to Time magazine, a military official says about 140 of the 660 prisoners could be released. The Associated Press is reporting it could happen sometime this month or in January. Joining us on the line from Washington is Vivica Novak of Time magazine. Welcome, Vivica.
Good to be with you.
Vivica, tell us about the decision.
Well, this is something that's been in the works for a while. The processing of the detainees, the sorting out of who belongs there and who doesn't, who should be charged and who shouldn't, has taken an extraordinarily long time. There have been many complaints from our allies and even internally within our government. And when the Supreme Court announced this fall that it would hear a case brought by some detainees addressing the question of whether they have a right to challenge their detention in court at all, which the U.S. government maintains they don't, at that point, when the Supreme Court announced it would take the case, the processing of these detainees speeded up, apparently, and has led to essentially the clearing for release or transfer of about 140 of them.
These men and boys are under suspicion of terrorism, very serious stuff, and yet there is a Kafkaesque or Alice in Wonderland quality, isn't there, you write about in the Time magazine article, to a lot of these detentions.
Well, I think the biggest factor is that they don't know, these people don't know when they'll be getting out, if they'll be getting out, if they're going to be charged, what they're going to be charged with. They just have no idea what's going to happen to them. You know, most people who are behind bars, they can sort of, you know, mark another notch on the wall with every day that goes by in their sentence.
I mentioned Alice in Wonderland. I did that because a lawyer for some of the British detainees says that in order to get charged with an offense down there and in order then to get a lawyer, you have to plead guilty.
Well, that is true. We're not allowing them access to lawyers, and most of them probably aren't even going to be charged and brought before a military tribunal, which raises the question, what is going to happen to them?
The military has acknowledged that at least a few of these detainees were actually kidnapped by warlords in Afghanistan, right? Warlords looking for a reward from the U.S. military in return for turning someone in who was an alleged terrorist, right?
Yes, the U.S. was offering a bounty for every member of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda that was turned in. There were some warlords who turned people in who may well not have been involved with Al-Qaeda or the Taliban.
These are very difficult balances, though, aren't they? Because some of these men could be bad guys.
That's right. And that's why they are interrogating them so intensely and so, tirelessly, really. They have interrogation teams, four-person interrogation teams that they call Tiger Teams, working 24 hours a day. And they're interrogating people for between 1 and 16 hours at a time. And these interrogation teams consist of a linguist and an analyst and two interrogators. So they are working very hard to get all the intelligence information they can out of them.
Vivekha, are they still getting new and fresh intelligence 2 years on?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, you know, there are new detainees who are coming in, and I assume that they are providing some intelligence perhaps. But the people who have been there a long time, I think that the greatest use for them right now is to, as we gather intelligence from other sources abroad, that we can bounce things off them and see if they know, you know, various names that come up. Have they heard of this person or that person? Or, you know, perhaps find out where some financing came from. It's possible that they can be of marginal use at this point in that regard. But certainly, I think their greatest use is behind them at this point.
Vivekha Novak of Time Magazine, thanks very much for joining us.
It's good to be with you.
Some public health advocates are calling it the most ambitious global health initiative ever undertaken. The World Health Organization today released a blueprint for treating 3 million people with AIDS by the end of 2005, a plan they're calling 3x5. The plan includes distribution of simplified antiretroviral drugs, simplified monitoring of patients and the drug supply, and the training of thousands of healthcare workers. Dr. Gottfried Hernschall of the WHO joins us on the line from Geneva. Good afternoon, doctor.
Good afternoon.
Thanks so much for joining us. Can you tell us a little bit about the highlights of the plan?
You've already mentioned some of them. One, obviously, is to have simplified, standardized tools available for countries. So what we are developing and what we are putting on our website today, actually, are simplified, standardized guidelines for ARV treatment.
I'm looking, for instance, at the delivery of drugs. The WHO is recommending 4 3-dose combinations of drugs. How does that compare to the usual dosage?
Currently, there are about 35 first-line treatment regimen available, which is very confusing, not only for the prescriber, but also for those people in the programs who have to secure the supply of drugs. Particularly for resource-constrained setting, it's going to an advantage to simplify and to reduce the number of options to a smaller number. This does by no means mean that those options that we are proposing are suboptimal. These are regimens that are currently being also prescribed and used in the Northern Hemisphere.
For instance, when it comes to monitoring, you're recommending that a patient's health be monitored perhaps as simply as watching body weight. What do you say to those who say that this is substandard compared to, you know, the treatment an AIDS patient receives in an industrialized country?
Well, I clearly say this is not true, mm-hmm. and that I'm saying that probably what is currently being done is a little bit chaos in the developed world, and it's unnecessary. And we need to ensure that minimum standards of care are being provided. Currently, very few people, between 1% and 2% in Africa, of those people who would require ARV treatment, who are currently dying, will probably, over the next few years, have access to life-saving treatment. And that would really help us to turn a fatal disease into a chronic condition.
We look at the numbers. The WHO has said that there are 40 million people worldwide who are HIV infected, 6 million with AIDS. This blueprint talks about treating 3 million. I'm sure it doesn't go as far as you'd like it to.
Obviously, the 3 million target by 2005 is only one important milestone in the overall goal towards achieving universal access to treatment. And we hope that while we now move along towards moving this important target, we will soon be able to identify a time when we will hopefully achieve universal access. But we do feel that it is important to get started somewhere and to collect some positive experience in those countries that currently don't have that, and then to move towards a full-scale ART program in those countries.
Mm. What about who's going to pay for it? The anticipated cost is about $5.5 billion over the next 2 years.
Those $5.5 billion that you were mentioning just for ARV treatment, not including other aspects on prevention and care, some of this has already been pledged. Some of this has already been committed. What needs to happen now is that at each country, the various sources of funds are, so to speak, put together into a well-coordinated plan of action.
Doctor, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Dr. Gottfried Hernschall of the HIV-AIDS Department of the World Health Organization, he spoke to us from Geneva.
Just ahead, a presidential recall in Venezuela and new evidence about the disappeared in Chile.
There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Well, they're at it again in Venezuela, another in a series of attempts to bring down the country's president, Hugo Chavez. Today, a four-day petition drive ends, which organizers say will produce the more than 2 million signatures they need to force a referendum on Chavez. Though the president's been busily shoring up his support among the country's poor by throwing money at them in the form of new government projects. Well, joining us from Caracas is Juan Forero of the New York Times. Thanks for joining us, Juan.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Juan, what is the opposition to President Hugo Chavez so upset about? This has gone on for years now.
Well, they believe that Hugo Chavez is taking Venezuela on a far-left path. They believe that this country is becoming more and more like Cuba.
Juan, this is a class struggle to a certain extent, right? The people who are against President Chavez tend to be the middle and upper classes, and the people who support him, the lower classes, yeah?
It depends on who you talk to. Certainly the opposition tries to cast itself as much more representative of the entire Venezuelan society. The government tries to point out that many of the people in the opposition happen to be wealthy, happen to be upper middle class. And certainly the president has strong support in some of the barrios here, the poor districts of Venezuela.
Where does oil fit into all this? Venezuela is the most oil-rich nation in the Americas. Why should the country be having economic problems at all? Is it mismanagement?
Well, the opposition says it is. They say that the government doesn't know what it's doing. They say that there's a range of populist policies that really aren't very well thought out that are hurting the economy. The government itself, they try to argue that it's the opposition that's at fault, having launched a coup, a failed coup against President Chavez, and four national strikes.
Juan, just to finish up, if this does come to a referendum as early as March, what's the betting line? Could President Chavez be thrown out of office?
Well, the polls show he has about 35% to 40% support. So it is quite possible. There are a lot of caveats, though. Venezuelans are traditionally apolitical, so the opposition needs to get a lot of people to the polls. They have to get 3.7 million of 12 million voters to vote for the president's recall. That's more votes than the president received in his reelection in 2000.
Juan Forero of the New York Times joined us from Caracas, Venezuela. Thanks very much, Juan.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, the political upheaval that continues to define Venezuela's present has largely ended in Chile, but that country's past does continue to shadow it. It's estimated at least 3,000 people disappeared in Chile under the rule of Augusto Pinochet, the general who seized power in 1973 and ruled until 1990. Human rights activists still hope to get Pinochet into court to face charges, though he's been depicted as too old and senile. But in a recent interview with Miami's Spanish language channel 22, Pinochet sounded articulate and combative. He said he never wanted to be a dictator and that he was, in fact, a patriotic angel.
Yo siempre actué con sentido democrático.
Despite what the general just said, many Chileans think of him as an angel of death. and new information is now surfacing about his regime's brutality and how it was covered up. The newspaper La Nación in Chile is reporting new court testimony about the bodies of disappeared people, desaparecidos, being dumped into the Pacific Ocean from military helicopters, the bodies weighed down by pieces of railroad track. The new testimony is from military helicopter mechanics. Joining us on the line now from Santiago, Chile, is correspondent Jorge Escalante, who wrote the story. Welcome, Jorge.
Hello.
Jorge, who are the men giving this testimony?
They are under officers from the Chilean Army who, for many years, they keep this secret.
Mm-hmm. What is the secret, Jorge?
They keep for about 30 years to take the body of prisoners into helicopters, and they throw the bodies into the sea.
Jorge, there have been such stories for many years in Chile about bodies being thrown from helicopters. What's the importance of this new testimony?
For the first time, the people who participate in this operation, they speak. Before, there was rumors and...
Yes, the Army a couple of years ago put out a document indicating that they believed such human rights abuses may have happened.
But the problem was that in this list, there was missing about 500 cases, 500 names. In Santiago, in the capital of Chile, they disappeared between 1973 and 1978, 590 persons, prisoners.
Jorge, what's the reaction been in Chile to your reports?
Yeah, I was thinking very deep if it was good or not to publish this information. Because when you think there are families, they are searching for information, searching for the final destiny, and they don't know. I was talking with some of them before I published, and they say, you must publish that. It will be very hard for us, but the country must know the truth, and the world must know the really truth, what happened really with these prisoners. No?
Yeah. Where could this investigation lead now? Could this reach to General Pinochet?
I was talking today with some lawyers of some of these cases, and they are thinking how they can reach now Pinochet.
He's been granted a certain immunity because he's said to be somewhat senile, but in fact he's given a fairly coherent interview to Channel 22 in Miami.
Yes, when you see that now General Pinochet can answer a lot of questions, you see that this person, it's impossible that this person is had memory problems. Now the people in Chile see and confirm that everything was an intent to save Pinochet, no?
Jorge Escalante, thank you very much.
Okay.
Jorge Escalante is a correspondent for the newspaper La Nación in Chile.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, the Bush administration is reportedly reconsidering tariffs on steel imports. How will that play in steel country?
If you look around the Pittsburgh area, Robin, you'll see not steel producers, but places where steel once was produced.
And if there's a classical music lover on your list, listen up. Here and Now's Ellen Pfeiffer offers some of her favorites.
For the opera lover, there's a new recording of Massenet's Manon with Renee Fleming, who is a very hot ticket at the moment.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Dolores Handy. With the recent insurgent attacks in Iraq, the U.S. military says it is trying to avoid harming civilians. Lourdes Navarro is in Baghdad.
U.S. commanders and soldiers who took part in this operation say that they were attacked first. They did return fire. However, they stressed that they tried to limit their fire to people holding guns, those launching attacks at them.
That report from Lourdes Navarro. Activists and health workers rallied around the globe today to mark World AIDS Day, seeking support for the continuing battle against a disease that ravaged a record number of people in 2003. The United Nations says more people than ever died or were infected by HIV/AIDS in 2003, with 3 million deaths and another 5 million cases of infection. Globally, between 34 million and 46 million people are believed to have the virus. The Department of Homeland Security is ending a program that required tens of thousands of mostly middle-aged Middle Eastern men and boys to register with the government. The department says its decision was not influenced by harsh criticism from civil rights organizations. The program, begun after September 11th, was intended to help assure the government that no known terrorists were in the United States. The U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to clarify just when employers can be sued for sexual harassment. The court will decide the case of a woman who quit her job as a state police dispatcher in Pennsylvania after what she calls persistent harassment by her male bosses. The Supreme Court never has decided whether people who voluntarily quit their jobs and then claim harassment have the same legal rights as those who are fired. Lawyers for teenage sniper suspect Lee Malvo have failed in their attempt to get convicted sniper John Muhammad to testify at his trial. They're arguing that Muhammad brainwashed Malvo, turning him into a killer. But Muhammad's lawyers are refusing to allow him to testify because Muhammad still faces prosecution elsewhere. A jury has already convicted Muhammad and recommended that he be sentenced to die in the death of one of the 10 victims of last year's Washington, D.C. sniper shooting spree. On Wall Street at midday, stocks are higher. The Dow is up 100 points at 98.82. The Nasdaq is up 24 points. The S&P 500 is up 10 points. This is Here and Now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
According to today's Washington Post, the Bush administration may soon blink on the steel tariff standoff. President Bush is expected to announce this week that he will lift the tariffs placed on steel imports to protect the American steel industry. This after a ruling from the World Trade Organization that the tariffs violated trading laws and in the face of billions of dollars of retaliatory tariffs from Japan and Europe. But the Bush administration is not budging on another front. Vice President Dick Cheney, facing lawsuits from two private groups, has refused to disclose files from his energy task force. The Supreme Court is considering the administration's appeal on the matter and may release a decision on whether or not they'll take it up next week. Well, when to hold 'em, when to fold 'em. That's the subject of our weekly D.C. roundtable. Joining us on the line is Sarah Fritz, Washington bureau chief for the St. Petersburg Times. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Robin.
We're also joined by David Tribman, executive editor of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette in Pittsburgh. Hello, David.
Hello there, Robin.
And David, I want to start with you. Pittsburgh is a steel town. This lifting of tariffs, how are people going to react to that?
People will not be pleased if this does happen. The most amazing thing to me is that the president should make a decision about this issue this week, in the very week in which he's visiting places like Detroit and Pittsburgh, which are be very, very hard hit by such a decision.
Pittsburgh is a scheduled visit with the president tomorrow.
Yes, tomorrow he has a fundraiser here. It may turn into a fundraiser plus protest or fundraiser plus something else.
Well, Sarah, we know that the Europeans in particular were threatening to use retaliatory tariffs on industries in states that will be critical to the president in the 2004 election. So President Bush was really between a rock and a hard place
right.
on this one.
I saw his first decision to impose this tariff as a political move in order to win those states that David is talking about. And I think that what he has done here is simply revert to form. He's always been a free trader.
Mm-hmm. David, how do you talk to your readership about this issue? I talked to a steel expert about this whole tariff issue and asked, well, why should steel be protected? Why doesn't it go the way of, let's say, the shoe business in New England? And he said that every country just feels that they have to have steel. There's something about it that they just refuse to let that industry decline.
Well, there's something elemental, of course, about steel. It is a part of all the manufacturing process. But if you look around the Pittsburgh area, Robin, you'll see not steel producers, but places where steel once was produced. And so there's almost no steel produced within the city of Pittsburgh anymore, the result of the decline in the steel industry of the 80s. And I do believe there's a sense in the country, here and elsewhere, that we ought to retain some steelmaking capacity because we can't be dependent upon this very important element completely from overseas sources.
We saw what happened with oil.
We saw what happened with oil, and if you could ask Sarah, who herself is a Pittsburgh native, she would tell you that this was part of the fabric of this community, or you might say the steel of this community.
Well, I'm wondering, Sarah, might President Bush say to the people in Pittsburgh, look, I held it in place as long as I could, and might that get him some points?
I think I don't know how Pittsburghers will react, but I think he won some points with them by imposing those tariffs to begin with. Mm-hmm. This has almost turned out for him to be kind of an object lesson that he can show to people who want him to restrict trade.
Okay, well, let's turn to the other line in the sand, if you will, this week. This one's being held by Vice President Dick Cheney. He's refusing to turn over the confidential records from his energy task force, despite two lawsuits. The Supreme Court is expected to issue a decision on whether or not to hear his appeal. David, how is this impacting the Bush administration, if at all?
Well, it's actually not the center of life in the administration right now, as you know, because there's still continuing hostilities in Iraq with some devastating events of the last couple of days. But it's a reminder that the administration can't do everything it wants to do in the kind of way it wants to do, and that there are checks and balances. Every administration, this isn't a Bush administration phenomenon, every administration runs into this sort of thing. Every administration bridles at the restrictions the Constitution and the broader society place on the conduct of government. And so this really isn't a surprise. Every administration has something. This happens to be theirs.
Sarah, do you agree? Because some are saying that this seems to be somewhat bigger, and especially Dick Cheney's role in what seems to be an ongoing battle to fight for greater presidential authority.
Right. Well, I think it creates that bad impression that this administration is in the pocket of energy and oil interests. And that impression is played out in the energy bill, which is still being discussed on Capitol Hill and will be at issue when the Congress comes back later this month. That bill gives a lot away to the energy industry, and I would certainly expect that the Democrats would make a big issue of, A, the Cheney consultations with the energy companies, and B, with the bill that the Republicans want to pass.
David, how do you think his appeal is going to fare? A federal judge and then a federal appeals court have both ruled that courts can order at least a limited inquiry into the decision-making process that his agency used.
Well, in the end, I think we all know what's going to happen. It's all going to come out. And it's a matter of how long it's going to take. The struggle is an enduring one. It goes back to the beginning of our republic. It involved President Washington in his own way, it famously involved President Nixon. The result is always the same. The stuff always comes out. The amazing thing to me is why they try to keep it in there.
Yeah.
Robin, there's the additional issue of Cheney's influence on the president, which is very controversial, not just in the area of energy, but also in the conduct of the war in Iraq. A lot of people like to say that Cheney is the person, in addition to Rumsfeld, who talked the president into going into Iraq. And so as these things mount, you see Cheney becoming a much, much more controversial figure in the administration.
And by the way, just remind us, while they are demanding more executive power, neither Vice President Cheney nor President Bush is invoking executive privilege in this case.
No, that's correct. Neither has done so. And of course, those words are fighting words on Capitol Hill and among Democrats, so it was very smart of them not to do so. But the principle is pretty similar.
Which is what? That just that there should be...
They should be able to conduct government with certain amount of privacy to protect who knows what, to protect their own interests, to protect the interests in privacy and commercial privacy of others, or maybe just because they want to do it themselves. But this is nothing. This is the same argument we've had administration after administration.
David, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And Sarah, thank you as well.
You're quite welcome.
David Shribman, executive editor of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Sarah Fritz, Washington bureau chief for the St. Petersburg Times of St. Petersburg, Florida, members of our weekly D.C. roundtable.
Still to come, are you just lost when it comes to buying music for the classical music lover on your list? Well, stay tuned.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Are the rainforests of the Amazon really, as they're so often called, the lungs of the world, emitting life-giving oxygen into the air? Well, a study released in the journal Science last week raises new questions about that. The study shows that in some places, the Amazon emits carbon dioxide, a key greenhouse gas, contributing, some say, to global warming. Well, joining us on the line is one of the authors of the study, Dr. Stephen Woofsey from Harvard University. And welcome, Dr. Woofsey.
Thank you for having me, Bill.
Well, Dr. Woofsey, the conventional wisdom, most people seem to assume the Amazon rainforest is the lungs of the world, not pouring out the greenhouse gas carbon dioxide. What have you learned?
Well, it's actually a controversy as to whether or not the Amazon forest would be taking up carbon dioxide or releasing it to the atmosphere, and it really depends on whether the size of the forest, the total amount of wood and organic matter, is increasing or decreasing. So the forest will always be taking up CO2 and releasing CO2 and always taking up oxygen to use for life processes and giving off oxygen as part of photosynthesis. So it's the balance that we're interested in. Is more being taken up than put out, and vice versa.
Part of your study has to do with deadwood, too. Can you explain that?
Yes. Well, we were interested in whether or not the vulnerability of the forest to drought would be demonstrated in a place where You have a regular rainforest, very green with lots of rain, but a significant dry period and periodic droughts. And so we went to this place, which had been subjected to quite a severe drought in the late 90s, as associated with the big El Nino of the late 90s. And what we found was that the living part of the forest, the greenery, was actually growing very fast. So there's more carbon being stored in the living vegetation than is being decaying out of the living vegetation. But there was also a tremendous amount of deadwood. And we believe that that deadwood originated during the drought period. And on balance, take the two processes together, the decaying deadwood, the growing live wood, and it turns out that this forest is a small source of CO2 on a year-to-year basis over the last 3 years. And that's showing, I think it's showing, that the forest is in fact vulnerable to drying of the climate. And should indeed climate change lead in that direction, as some of the climate models have predicted, we might expect a very significant degradation of that forest.
And a forest that's putting out more CO2 than oxygen.
That's right. And what that would do, of course, is tend to enhance the amount of CO2 already in the atmosphere. So you could regard that as an amplification of climate change, if you will, adding more CO2 due to the fact that climate has warmed.
Dr. Wolfsey, take a moment, if you would, as we finish up, just to bring our listeners to where you've been. What is that forest like to be inside of?
It's a really beautiful place. Some of the trees are as tall as 55 meters. They're huge, giant trees. It's very, very rich in terms of the species diversity. There's many different types of plants, several hundred species of trees. Beautiful snakes, if you admire snakes, spiders, lots of ants, and just a wonderful environment and a place of great beauty and mystery.
Dr. Stephen Wolfsey joined us from Harvard University. Doctor, thanks very much.
Thank you, Bill.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
That, of course, is an excerpt from Handel's Messiah, a sure harbinger of the Christmas season. But for music lovers, there is a life beyond Messiah and the Nutcracker, classical music that carries us through the holidays, but beyond them, too. Here in Now's classical music connoisseur, Alan Pfeiffer has put together a selection of gifts that run the gamut from serious to scholarly to utterly unclassifiable. And Alan joins me now in the studio. Hi, Alan.
Hi, Bill.
Well, Alan, let's get right at it. A lot of gifts under the tree.
That's true. And the first one I have is a recording of Vladimir Horowitz. You might know that this is the 100th anniversary of his birth.
Uh-huh.
And several record companies have come out with anniversary recordings. This one is on Sony, and it's a reissue of a 1965 concert he did. It was his big comeback after about a 12-year hiatus. Very historic event. What's interesting about this is that it was previously released, but it was touched up. Hmm. Even though it was meant to be a live recording, it was, in fact, not entirely live. And
touched up. What did they do to it?
Well, they fixed some mistakes. And there was a...
Horowitz mistakes?
Yes. He did the Schumann Fantasy, which is a notoriously difficult piece. And at the end of the second movement in the coda, which is especially difficult, he really kind of lost it for a minute. And at the end of the concert, after everybody went home, he re-recorded a few takes.
All right. Well, let's listen to the fallible Vladimir Horowitz.
Yes. That's Horowitz in a selection from the CD Live and Unedited. I should probably mention, too, that it comes with a DVD that is an excerpt from the movie Horowitz, The Last Romantic, and it's pretty interesting. It has all these very tight close-ups of his hands.
And that was a rather flawless performance there, despite the errors that apparently do shine through this disc. It's so comforting to know that guys like that can make mistakes.
That's very true.
What else you got?
Well, for the opera lover, there's a new recording of Massenet's Manon with Renee Fleming, who is a very hot ticket at the moment, and Marcelo Alvarez, who, as you may remember, is one of the so-called three new tenors. And it's a live performance from the Paris Opera. This scene that we're about to hear is just my favorite moment in the opera. It's where Manon, who has abandoned her lover Des Grieux for a richer, older sugar daddy, decides that she wants to win Des Grieux back. And the poor guy, he just doesn't have a chance. She goes up to him and she says, "Isn't this the hand that used to caress you? Isn't this my eyes, which used to have so much charm for you, now sparkling through their tears?" And as the voice caresses, the hand caresses, it's just a dynamite seduction scene.
Selection from Massenet's Manon featuring Renee Fleming. Ellen, I also see in your collection someone you've mentioned before, pianist Dubravka Tomsic.
Yes, she's a great favorite in New England. She's Slovenian and was introduced to all of us at the Newport Music Festival a number of years ago. And she came out with this Liszt recording earlier in the year that's just fabulous. And what we're going to hear now is an excerpt from the Mephisto Waltz. And the thing about this is just so fabulous. It's so clear. It's so beautiful in tone, even though it's one of the most notoriously difficult pieces in the literature. And she just dispatches it with such ease.
Pianist Dubravka Tomsic performing Liszt. You've heard about a bunch of CDs now. What about books?
Well, I have a couple recommendations. I also talked about this earlier in the year, Maynard Solomon's late Beethoven book. I think the chapter on the pastoral in poetry and in music, and particularly Beethoven's music, is worth the price of the book itself. And then something a lot of fun for me is any of Janis Weber's books, but particularly her thrillers, which feature a violinist and secret agent named Leslie Frost.
Happens all the time.
They're just such, they have such personality. She's such an interesting character. I just want to read a little bit from the opening of Frost the Fiddler.
Sure.
"I'm Smith. There are only two of us left now. used to be 7, but Vassar got her wrists slashed under the Eiffel Tower. Wellesley slipped into the Bosphorus on Valentine's Day. Holyoke did a swan dive off a balcony in Tokyo. Bad luck. At least each of them had the foresight to make her death look like a bimbo suicide. Last year, Bryn Mawr, then Radcliffe, vanished in Africa, leaving Barnard and me alone with Maxine, the queen. Of the 7, I've been the queen's class brat, and Maxine seems to resent my outlasting the sweetheart Vassar, who heeled like a champion spaniel, or Holyoke, who would hack off her right foot for America. I'm a patriot, not a kamikaze.
Okay, I'm hooked.
Janice Weber is fabulous. She's a pianist, but she has an incredible imagination, and she writes about a violinist who rides around on a Harley with her Strad strapped to the back of the Harley.
Typical everyday scene here in Boston. The name of the book again?
Frost the Fiddler, the second one, which is Hot Ticket.
Well, Ellen, I mentioned in the introduction music from the serious to the unclassifiable. Any good gift that's a bit hard to categorize?
Oh, have I got one for you. This is a guy named Ryuichi Sakamoto, and he's a Japanese composer, classically trained, who has what they call a restless sensibility. And he's done film scores like The Last Emperor and Little Buddha. And I wanted to play just a bit of the Little Buddha overture because it's such a ripoff of Samuel Barber's Adagio for Strings. This is probably one of the more conventional pieces on this recording, but the other stuff on there is just unclassifiable.
And this, of course, from the movie Little Buddha, directed by Bernardo Bertolucci.
That's correct.
Yeah, you do. You hear Samuel Barber. You also hear the Oliver Stone movie Platoon, which used Samuel Barber in the movie.
Yes, I guess you could just say that this is a guy
who soaks
up every influence around him.
Well, Ellen, you've given us some great gift ideas for everybody else, but what about you? What do you want for Christmas or whatever holiday you're planning to celebrate?
Manon is such a favorite opera of mine. I remember seeing it when I was a student. I saw Beverly Sills in it. I went back 3 or 4 times. And this recording also comes as a DVD, and I would like the DVD.
Okay. More from Massenet's Manon there. Ellen Pfeiffer, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Ellen Pfeiffer came in with her own Christmas wishes and maybe some ideas for the rest of us this holiday season. For more information on Ellen's holiday gift-giving ideas, check out our website at here-now.org.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories Here and Now.
We'll hear from the congressman from Ohio who wants to be your president, Dennis Kucinich.
And the FDA considers whether to okay the experimental use of computer chips in people's brains.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.